Well, hi everyone. It's Allison on the McDowell sofa, and I'm just going to spend a little bit of time going over a map that I've worked on. I was a little bit slow about it. It's sort of the confluence of a number of different resources. Some friends of mine had sent Sephers and friend Darshan and Hanging Thief and Natasha and I think Melanie, like a number of people sort of had things have come to my inbox recently, and they all sort of started to converge. And so I thought I'd do sort of a stream of consciousness map centered around the fires in Maui. And I know a lot of people have already been talking about that, and now we're on to our next disaster, which I guess is flooding in Southern California. But, you know, for me, I wanted to sort of put my own spin on it because I've really been focused on this idea of the socio-technical cyber-physical systems and the way in which society is being modeled as a cellular organism through embryology and division and cell division and, you know, identification and grouping and regrouping to sort of build this global networked brain that Oliver Reiser has been talking about since, you know, 1946 in his World Sensorium. You know, I wanted to use the fires in the context of Hawaii as a, you know, highly militarized island nation, again, sort of the struggle between indigenous practice, indigenous Polynesian practice, and U.S. empire practice, again, knowing that a lot of that polarizing narrative is being set up to drive things forward into a place that I think most people are not aware of what is coming. So that's why I wanted to talk about Jeremy Pitt and how that might apply to this jumpstart Maui project that someone had sent my way. I think it was Melanie. And so, you know, again, I think a lot of people out there might be framing this as, oh, look, it's a 15-minute city in Hawaii. But, you know, I've known for a long time that blockchain is really also about decentralized energy grid systems. And then that's at sort of this fractal level that we're using electrical energy to control us as crystalline beings, and then using the technologies to guide society and to develop this human computation, and then up and up and up. So the decentralized energy grid, running life, running natural life, you know, based in water and carbon through these energetic circuits, really that's a lot of what's behind the shift, the decarbonization shift, is the pivot into an electrical grid, because the electrical grid through the pulsing will be able to coordinate society at a much more granular level that they can do now through just managing economic structures. So I wanted to sort of look at this Jumpstart Maui, the smart energy, smart cars, smart grid that was set up a number of years ago. It was a partnership between Japan and the United States. And also partners in that were University of Hawaii and the Electrical System and the Economic Development Board. And then in Japan, Hitachi, Mizuho Bank, Cyber Defense Institute, and this entity called NEDO, N-E-D-O, which is the New Industry and Industrial Technology Development Organization. And they're actually affiliated with the Society 5.0, the Japan Moonshot Project. So, you know, I wanted to sort of bring this up and mention, because this diagram where you've got, you know, individual optimization and then total optimization, smart city platforms, right? You have a lot of it's hinging on electric vehicles and autonomous self-driving vehicles, battery power stations, how the batteries will be used in individual people's homes, and then how they will be networked into at a social level. So I believe that the networked circuitry there is part of the planned social computation program. And then on the front end, sure, it's going to look like they're interested in controlling your mobility. They're interested in controlling how long you can take a hot shower. They're interested in controlling, you know, that your thermostat, the Nest, all of those things. Controlling mechanisms are what most of the people are going to be talking about, is how they use the grid to control people in a sort of a top-down fashion. But I believe, based on the research that I've been looking at, that ultimately the goal is to use this circuit-based infrastructure to create quote-unquote choice points in behavior management that are going to lead to the creation of the hive mind and computer use sociality global networked network state brain project that is going to be used for some computational purpose. So it's not just that they're going to limit you in every way, but they're going to create a game board, and the game board is run in electrical circuitry, distributed electrical circuitry, because, again, they need it to have, in order for the choice aspect, the wisdom of crowds to be mined, it has to be decentralized, and that's why we're getting into the decentralized energy grid that is electrical, and that is going to be run through the blockchain. And that all of these things will be digitally twinned and nested in one another, because you've got the individual levels, which is individual houses, individual cars, individual villages, and then they're networked up into towns, cities, mega regions, right? And then all of that is twinned all the way down and then put into the predictive modeling that's going to be happening. So in this context, so this is sort of the launching point, is looking at the smart grid as a socio-technical system. Now, I do want to just take a minute to revisit this clip that I had played before of RFK Jr. I don't know that I'm going to need to play the whole thing, but this is from 2012. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was I don't know when he ended his relationship, but was a managing partner with Vantage Point Capital, and they had invested in a lot of emerging technologies, specifically clean tech. That was kind of his wheelhouse, is clean tech, and energy, alternative energy systems. And so he's pitching this idea of the decentralized energy grid in free market economics, and that his organization was changing legislation in California to advance that, but then shortly thereafter, we had the Enron disaster with the free market economics in energy, which ran all of the energy out of California so that they would buy it back at higher prices. So in this clip, he also sort of touches on the idea of human energy, and this human energy project is pretty important. So I'm just going to play a bit of this just to refresh people's memories if they sort of forgot that RFK Jr. and Vantage Point Capital are in the middle of all of this decentralized energy grid planning, smart grid planning.
A marketplace that turns every American into an energy entrepreneur, every home into a power plant.
So every American as an energy entrepreneur and every home as a power plant. Now keep that in mind, because that's really important as we move forward into synthetic biology and humans being the batteries.
And powers this country based upon American entrepreneurship and initiative and human energy and what Franklin Roosevelt called America's industrial genius.
So human energy, right? So he's interested in human energy, he's interested in entrepreneurship, and what I just want to reemphasize for people is that when you hear entrepreneur, I would substitute the word agent in a simulation. So if you're an entrepreneur, you're out there and you're, they imagine that everyone's going to think about people who are just small business owners, that you're entrepreneurs, but ultimately it's your choice architecture that you are an agent in the simulation, and that's what the modeling is about.
Other than Saudi Arabian oil. And, you know, we can do that. We have the capacity to do that. I'll just tell you, we have an irrational marketplace right now. In 49 states, the way that utilities make money is by burning as much energy as possible. So my group, Natural Resources Defense Council, rewrote the rules in California in 1982. So that the way the utilities make money in California is by conserving energy and reducing the use of carbon-based fuels. So, and this was not a radical idea. The way, before we had deregulation in this country, the way the utilities made money is they would, it's a regulated industry because it's a monopoly, so they have to go to the Public Utility Commission and say, I want to build a dam, a capital project that's going to cost $100 million. We want to make 15% profits per year, And we want your permission to build the dam and then to integrate our profits into the rate base so that all the ratepayers pay us back for the dam over time and give us a profit annually. They had to show need, and the PUC would stamp it approved, and they'd go ahead and build it. And they made guaranteed profit. So today in California, the utility CEOs will go to the Public Utility Commission and say, we want to tear the Edison light bulbs out of 1 million homes and replace them at our cost with LED light bulbs that provide better light and that are and that use 12% of the energy.
Well, on the LED, remember, optogenetics is really important, and the next phase of computation is all about optics and photonics. It's light-based computing. So addressing light and man-made light systems is actually really important when we understand what's coming in the next phase of how computing is going to happen next, after Moore's Law.
We want to go into 1 million homes and tear out antiquated hot water boilers and air conditioners and replace them with more efficient models that use 8 or 10% of the energy. It's going to cost us $100 million.
So what he's talking about there, again, this is 2012, but again, on the surface, it sounds perfectly reasonable, right? Energy efficient appliances. So of course we'd want energy, that sounds like a good plan. What I'm sure he knew at the time was that energy efficiency would be sensor-based smart appliances, and that would be part of your smart home, right? And all of it would be increasingly mediated through AI systems on blockchain. I don't know that he necessarily knew about blockchain in 2012, but he knew that it would be smart appliances and definitely that AI was going to be part of that, so this networked grid. And again, the framing is that this is a free market in energy and that you would be an energy entrepreneur in your home. And that sort of flies in the face of what we know what happened in terms of Enron, right? I guess you can imagine that John Arnold was an energy entrepreneur, right? And then that wrecked a whole bunch of people's situations and, you know, put people out of power and made people that have crazy energy bills. So he's framing it that this is about the little guy, like helping the little guy get more energy efficient appliances. But ultimately, Vantage Point has been investing in emerging tech, clean tech, biotech, optics, batteries for a very long time. They were one of the early backers of Tesla. Okay, they're backing their ocean drones, right? Liquid robotics, ocean drones. It's military tech masquerading as maybe consumer electronics, right? Or water quality monitoring, that sort of thing. But it's their ocean drones was what they were building. So Vantage Point's portfolio is really important to look at that and see the overlap. But this is the setup, was home-based energy entrepreneurism, and that you would have these appliances and that they would be factored into the energy systems. And that's what's going to be coming with sort of the Maui jumpstart. So I think that's probably enough there. So I'm just going to point out these are, again, it's still up there. This is the Vantage Point. See, again, copyright 2023, Vantage Point Capital Partners, venture partner Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and, you know, he came with NRDC, so he's the greenwashing that goes with all of the tech investments. And I don't think here it says that he specialized in clean tech, but that was his wastewater treatment was another focus, and I've written about that before. This is the homepage for their portfolio. They had 50 portfolio companies, 100 companies in diverse areas such as electric vehicles, biochemicals, advanced business services, internet and digital media, energy efficiency, social media, communications, robotics, healthcare, power management, cloud-based software, consumer technology, and advanced network hardware systems. Okay, so the energy efficiency part, the robotics, the power management, the advanced network hardware, that is all stuff that would be part of a smart city. And so when you're weighing your choices about who to support as a political candidate, assuming that you still find that useful, that frame, consider that's what RFK Jr. represents. That's where his bread is buttered, is in emerging technology and batteries and decentralized energy grids. This is from Vantage Point's homepage here. It says that you know, they're still focused on IT and digital media and healthcare and fintech, but they shifted towards energy innovation. All right. And I think we need to understand energy innovation as also nanotech, a lot of nanotechnology in that. So they're working on electric vehicles, including Tesla, scaling solar, and advanced biochemical innovator Genomica, LED lighting, we talked about that, BridgeLux, and many up-and-coming clean energy companies. So this alternative energy is important. And they're expanding this idea of energy innovation to include breakthrough technology in such diverse areas as wave-powered ocean drones. That's the surfboard Mary Holland told me about that Bobby was backing, the nice surfboard to monitor the water quality. No, ocean drones, Mary. Carbon conversion and sophisticated grid optimization systems. So sophisticated grid optimization systems, that would be the blockchain energy to run your smart village. And I pulled a couple of things from their portfolio here. Here you've got Tesla. That's just digital video. Optical networking, energy efficient storage, so batteries are really important. Next generation mobile power, lighting control systems. Again, lighting has to be understood as computing. High performance speakers. Again, so we've got the acoustics, micro optical products, voice over IP border control solutions. Right, perfect for your smart city or your 15-minute city. You can have a border anywhere with geofencing. Network switching solutions, intelligent automation for IT, that was acquired by Cisco. Celerex, biomanufacturing platform, that's GE Healthcare, again, because there's the smart village isn't going to be limited to your smart home. It's going to be your smart body with your digital electroceuticals. Here we've got some more LED lighting, and so that's the ones I wanted to highlight on that page. And let's see, we have one more. Here, 3VR, intelligent video for advanced security, right? So again, they're doing defense contracting, so advanced security. Trilliant, intelligent networking to power the smart grid. So you got smart grid, energy ecosystem connecting devices and utilities. That would be exactly in line with that Jumpstart Maui. Lithium chemistry, rechargeable storage. Again, more batteries, innovative silicon cell architecture for efficiency. So this is all about power distribution and power storage. And so I would say once you understand that part of things, the whole Maui situation, it's this idea of a socio-technical system, and this is something that Jason and Leo and I are going to spend a lot more time on this Michael Levin video breaking it down. But when Michael Levin is talking about embryology and using electricity in tissues to convey information and to rearrange things like frog faces and to look at morphogenesis, those same ideas are being used at a social level. And again, that's John Clippinger and Sandy Pentland at MIT Media Lab, the social physics, right? And again, we have the human-computer interface where we're digitally going to be connected through our digital twins and our digital identities on most likely on decentralized ledger systems to be twinned and steered. And so, again, it's not going to be a totalitarian steering that there's only one choice, but it's that the game board that we are going to be put in as agents/entrepreneurs will be mediated by smart contracts on blockchain, logic. They will be logic gates, and those logic gates will be circuits, and the circuits will be programmable, and they will be programmed with certain options. Certain options for some people, different options for other people, to create an orchestration where society gets played like an instrument towards some sort of larger computational process. And I believe that that's what's happening. So the circuitry, the battery storage, because again, it's decentralized. The goal is not to have one big power plant. that's too centralized. They want decentralized because the Web 3 is about the choice architecture and making that embedded in your environment through cyber-physical systems. So that choice architecture needs the decentralization. So it's going to need the next-gen nuclear, right? With your handy-dandy radioisotopes you can tap off the back, to manage whatever cancers that you've got with all this EMF radiation running through all of us. And it's going to need batteries to work, to hold the power, right? The batteries to hold the solar, the wind, and the nuclear, because they want it distributed. And so in that way, the battery systems are really central to the distributed grid. So I will also mention that there's some other information about these deep sea mining for emerging technologies. And this is coming online now. The UN is approving, in the process of approving, pilots for deep sea mining for what's called polymetallic nodules. And so they're down in the ocean. The ocean is going to be harvested for quote unquote this green, sustainable, decarbonizing solutions that are coming. And so that was, I guess, the first pilot was in last summer. And so now they're in the process of starting with doing the regulation of this. Here's an article, Seabed Mining and Blue Growth. And again, I will say, when I was looking at Bloomberg Philanthropies, you know, they have their hands in everything, in education and what works government and digital systems, digital transitions. They're also interested in the ocean as well. So they're looking at mineral deposits under the ocean, in the deep ocean, as a source of rare earth elements. And these rare earth elements, they call them short REEs. They have unique physical, chemical, and light-emitting properties and are needed in developing and implementing clean energy technologies. And again, clean tech, that's what Vantage Point was about. That was their emphasis, and that's, again, RFK Jr.'s alignment there. These materials, these rare earth elements, have multifunctional and industrial uses, such as high-strength magnets, medical devices, mobile phones, flat-screen TVs, energy-efficient lighting, and superconductors. So the energy efficient lighting, I mean, RFK Jr. was just talking about that in 2012. But these are all, again, we're going to kill the energy, the planet to save it. We're going to mine it to simulate it. We're going to, you know, and a lot of people have problems with this, fortunately. You know, it's good to know, but there's a lot of pressure behind needing to get this and creating a narrative that justifies it. So in Hawaii, that they're actually, this is from this spring, that there was legislation pushing for a ban on deep sea mining because there was concern that they would be in the proximity, that the impact from all of the, whatever it would be, dust or effluent off of the mining process would compromise the coral reefs and the habitat in and around Hawaii. So they're hoping that the legislators had a Senate Bill 376 to prohibit the extraction of minerals and mining in all state waters. And it says that it would not allow for any permits to be issued for any operation that impedes on Hawaii seabeds. So Hawaii is trying to at least put down, and I think this is really important because, you know, someone brought to my attention the focus on the fires. It's interesting because this is another long-term huge issue that if you're talking about fires, you're not talking about the deep sea mining. So that's important to understand. Again, here's another article. Permits for deep sea mining could affect waters near Hawaii. This was in July. So this is still a very current topic. It says the UN body that regulates the world's ocean floor is preparing to resume negotiations this month. That was July last month, or that was this past month. That would open the international seabed for mining, including materials vital for the green energy transition. Okay, so the UN is going to be pushing this as the green answer, right? And it says negotiations could affect deep-sea mining in an area called the Clarion-Clipperton Fracture Zone, which is 1.7 million square miles between Hawaii and Mexico. And again, we know that Mexico is down with all of this transition as well. So that's a lot of space, right? Imagine trying to come up with a narrative that justifies deep sea mining in 1.7 million square miles to save the planet. It doesn't add up. It's just not adding up. So the other aspect of this is that some of these rare earth minerals and the mining process unleash radiation. Okay, so there's radioactivity in these nodules, these polymetallic nodules. So this is from an article from May from Deep Sea Conservation Coalition. They're asking for a moratorium on deep sea mining after a scientific paper was released warning of alarmingly high concentrations of radiation in polymetallic nodules, which subsequently exceed safe international levels. Radioactive particles include radium-226, radium-222, thorium-230, and protactinium-231. Oh, sorry, it's radium-226, radon-222, thorium-230, and protactinium-231. Now, I will point out that thorium is being used in next-gen nuclear. So a lot of those reactors are thorium-based reactors, so that's important to notice. So there was a paper that came out in May that said the residual products from the mining slurry, that's the word, slurry, not dust, which is seawater, sediment, and nodule fines, would be released into the ocean as a discharge plume where radioactive particles could be ingested by marine organisms. And so they talk about the impact on humans of, like, maybe eating these deep sea, but really the ocean, like, we're mining it, like, mining. And, you know, John Trudell was always talking about that, the mining of the earth, just the violence of that mining process, not to mention the radioactivity. And, you know, in the past, we've talked about radiation hormesis. That's something, you know, that they're going to start to be promoting, this idea that low doses of radiation are actually good for you, right? Incurring mutations is actually beneficial somehow. So that's on the way. And so here is just another thing, just pointing out Vantage Point. This is from 2012. I guess they were having some issues. It says fundraising and personnel woes hit even the largest clean tech VC players. So they're in clean tech. This is a list of the firm's clean tech investments, including, so they have two sections, lighting and efficient semiconductors. And again, eventually light is going to be the new kind of computing. So we've got the lighting, but then we have Vantage Point smart grid investments. And that included Trilliant for smart grid communications, Emoli lithium ion batteries, and Amprius battery components. And then other stuff included a Better Place EV charging and battery leasing. And those electric vehicles, that's exactly what the Jumpstart Maui is about. This stuff. These are the electric vehicles. RFK Jr. and Vantage Point are heavily invested, or have been in the past, heavily invested in the development of this infrastructure. Like, it's just there. They just tell you exactly what it's about. So I'm sure that the task before them is going to be to, if they haven't brainwashed all the resistance already, is to, if there are people who are skeptical, they're going to have to try to frame this smart grid technology and these electric vehicles and the battery systems as a liberatory entrepreneurial effort, right? So that's what they're going to have to do. But it's pretty clear for most people who are skeptical about exactly what's happening in the quote-unquote greening, the mining, deep-sea mining for green, that it's not adding up, right? That none of this stuff is adding up, and that it's not actually about liberation. It's about predictive modeling and cybernetic control grids. So, you know, I'm going to just mention over here, this is, somebody also brought this to my attention. IEEE, which, you know, I've been sort of a gadfly in some of the IEEE metaverse webinars, that they were actually planning to have a conference in Maui in October, and in the area that was hit by the fire. And so they've since relocated to a different part of the Hawaiian Islands that, so they're now in Honolulu, they said they were just felt really bad about it, but they've relocated. But the conference was on systems, man, and cybernetics. So that's quite interesting. Like, we're looking at Jumpstart Maui. And the Jumpstart Maui project, it was in, I'm not sure the date. It's like 2018 or 2016, I think. So it's the NITO Smart Community Case Study, Japan-U.S. Collaborative Smart Grid. And, yes, so it says during the period between 2011 and 2016. So, actually, it's been a while. So it started more than 10 years ago. And again, it's U.S.-Japan, so that's, again, the Moonshot Project collaboration. So they were testing out on 30 families this smart grid. And that's the same time frame that Vantage Point was involved in that. So so that you've got the MAN, the IEEE Conference on Systems, MAN, and Cybernetics, which is quite something to have them cleared out and moved over to Oahu so that – but this is what it's about, MAN, Systems, and Cybernetics. So there was a listing of some of the abstracts here, and let's see. I guess they're different papers. So there was a list of abstracts of papers that were going to be presented, and I just picked a few that seemed appropriate. So here is one that's on sentiment analysis-based human-machine teaming, and again, you and your house are going to be a team. You and your car are going to be a team. You and the village are going to be teams. Like, it's all going to be digital teaming. And then it says, for improved situational awareness in simulation environments. So, again, sentiment analysis. They need to know what your emotions are and how you're feeling to feed it back to the machines that we're interacting with. Here's another one, cybernetic telepresence humanoid avatar robotic astronauts who are going to be your doctors. And so here's a picture down here of a guy in a hospital bed with a humanoid-ish, sort of a basic humanoid robot with a digital face on it. And talking about these humanoid avatars that have frontier tech like AR, extended reality, spatial computing headsets like HoloLens, and they have sensors and haptics and cameras so that, you know, your doctor can be anywhere, but framing this in a space context. And there's another one about the need for ethics education for responsible research around brain-machine interfaces and neurotechnology. So, yeah, the horse is way out of the barn there before we've even actually had any of the ethics conversations. So that's an interesting connection to Maui, that the conference was planning to be there in October. This new energy and industrial technology development organization, this is the press release for the demonstration project. And again, now, their press release originally said it started in 2011. This press release is from 2013, but it carried on through 2026. And it says here that they were going to model smart grid technologies. This is all about decarbonization, low carbon, social infrastructure, right? Social infrastructure, I believe, is about human computation, socio-technical systems, cyber-physical systems. That's what Jeremy Pitt was focused on. And so it said that based on the results and evaluation of the project, which had 30 families, I believe, that they would be building a business model for the future island smart grids that will be built in other subtropical regions with environmental conditions similar to Maui. And so we know that actually a lot of the blockchain crypto space has been targeting islands. Now, of course, there are financial and covert aspects to having offshoring, you know, these projects. But a lot of island nations have also been targeted with adopting crypto. I'm trying to think. I know that Celo is active in the Philippines. I'm not sure if they're working in other island areas, but this idea of alternative currency, because if you're going to start with developing and reimagining society as a computational infrastructure through smart contracts and maybe bioelectronic medicine and extended reality, you're going to start small. So you'll want to focus on islands. The other thing with these islands is a lot of them, especially in the Pacific, they're hammering really hard on sea level change. So there's a lot of emphasis. So I can imagine that they would be able to advance a lot of these sort of, to me, very problematic emerging tech systems in the name of sustainability on island nations, because they are the narrative is that they are under threat from sea level rise, and so they're going to be able to insert these policies as solutions, right? The decentralized grid policies, and small countries are perfect for these early test beds. And they say it right here in the press release. You know, we're using Hawaii, but the plan is to develop a case model that we can deploy all throughout Polynesia. These similar island nations. And this is from the NIDO website, and it's specifically talking about Society 5.0, which is cyborg avatar capitalism, that we will, you know, the Moonshot Project Goal 1, that we will live outside of a physical mind and body in time and space by 2050. So this is a page from NIDO's website that talks about robotics and AI. Robots, drones, AI, electric aircraft, and automated driving. So they're working on the robots. And here it says, as Japan presses ahead to achieve the smarter human-centered Society 5.0 with extensive adoption of AI, NIDO will encourage the practical application of relevant technologies with priorities in the prioritized areas of productivity, health, medical, welfare, and mobility. NIDO intends to develop an evolutionary AI system, and again, that's fitness, like comparing fitness protocols, that's algorithmic, and that's tied to the smart contract layer, I believe, that an evolutionary AI system evolving together with humans and using innovative remote tech to serve future generations, okay? And so I believe that this Society 5.0, it's really important to understand because the area that was devastated by the fires was an anchor of indigenous culture and history on of the Hawaiian kingdom, right, before it was overthrown by the U.S. government. And so this, I think, you know, I'm going back to some of my previous work around smart cities as Indian reservations and the difference between caring for the environment in right relationship, which is what Robin Rall Kimmerer talks about, right? The indigenous ways of knowing that we are relatives to all of the world that should be, and we should be cognizant of caring for the environment and for all of the seven generations, right? In respect to our ancestors and for caring for the generations ahead of us. Well, and I won't say us because I'm not indigenous, but that viewpoint that we should be carrying out ahead, but as a relative, and actually as the younger relative that should be looking to the older relatives of the stones and the plants' life and the lichen and the algae for those lessons of what that is. And increasingly that's being reframed out as sort of bio-inspired design with nanotech computing and this deep sea mining project, right? And so what I want to ask people to do is in thinking about this, what happened in Maui, I think the tendency will be to focus on, you know, the nature of those fires. The overall agenda, I think, will probably be likely associated with 15-minute cities, and it will just dovetail with that established narrative. But I would say we actually have to understand the imperial construct around the Hawaiian kingdom and its very deep militarization and its distance and its importance strategically for military purposes, but also I think the energetics of the culture there and it's living in a complex environment, right? Indigenous people in those volcanic island nations, you have tremendous power. You have the volcanic power. You have the waveform power. You have, you know, the diversity of tropical, you know, well, at least before invasive species, but this amazing diversity of climate and environments in these very small spaces. If you were looking at complexity and emergence, you would look to some place like Hawaii. And so understanding this tension between indigenous ways of knowing and being and militarized sustainability ways of knowing and being, I see them as counterbalancing one another, but increasingly there are plans afoot to pull the indigenous ways of knowing through STEM education, emerging tech, centering on indigeneity to bring especially girls and women, into the fold, right, as an opportunity to close the digital divide and to bring that way of being in. And when you look at my last blog post, you know, I talked about, I paid a visit to Carlisle Indian School, which is the model for the really barbaric residential boarding school / prison that attempted to erase indigenous culture, right? So that attempted erasure hasn't gone away, but in the future it will look like attempted integration into a cyber-physical way of being. That the cyber-physical system, because it will be, again, human-centered, Society 5.0 is human-centered, so the humanity becomes machine-readable, that our biology will be... social systems, environmental systems will be pulled into the nanotech, into synthetic biology, semiconductors of hybrid biocomputation of living cells and machine inanimate things, and that will be framed as something that is entirely appropriate. And, you know, from that paper, like, we need to have some ethical conversations. And I would say, personally, I don't find it appropriate at all. So here I will also touch briefly on this idea of creative destruction. And this is part of a map that I made a while back. I was focused on Peter Drucker and how Peter Drucker and he's an Austrian management. Well, he was originally from Austria and then he came to the U.S. He was a highly regarded management theorist. He was promoting decentralization, the importance of corporate culture. He was even talking about corporate-sponsored UBI, diminishing the government, putting things in the hands of corporations. He was very influential with Bob Buffert on the development of the Christian megachurch movement in the 1980s. And a friend of his father, and who was a deep influence on him, was a gentleman by the name of Joseph Schumpeter. And he was a finance minister for Austria, and he was focused on evolutionary economics. And so, and Pavel Lukcha, actually, who was with Global Education Futures, was interested in evolutionary economics. And so if you imagine the economic modeling, economic forecasting, economic simulations, signaling, right? You'll talk about price signaling, the information that's come through the economic pathways, the ways in which, absence Bretton Woods, right, we have the IMF, we have the World Bank, so we do have a global system that is controlling and guiding economic relations among countries, right, and they would say ostensibly for homeostasis, although a lot of it ended up being terrible structural adjustment that put the global south under the thumb of sort of the global north in the last round. And now the global south being under the thumb meant that it was underdeveloped and that now they can be leapfrogged into the Web3 fintech microfinance, entrepreneurship, microfinance entrepreneurship economy. And that's what all of the Web3 crypto folks are now doing in Cardano. There are the energetics of the economic modeling system, right? So now we actually are being sold the idea that distributed ledger technologies melded with sensor networks will create social systems that can be programmable and sustainable, right? And move us towards a better balance, right? That would be an evolutionary process because, again, in the game board, you would program the game board for certain amounts of choice architecture for the wisdom of the crowd. You would allow the simulation, the game, to play out that round. You would see what happened on that round, and then you would reshape the game board. And that's something we talked about with complexity with Alicia Warrero. So that idea, that is an evolutionary process, right? You have a goal-oriented behavior. You run, you simulate it, you structure the game board, you run it in real time, you have everything embedded in sensor networks that's getting real-time data flows, and then you use that to feed the next prediction modeling. And that is a guided evolution. And it's the smart contracts and the distributed, the protocol layer runs on electricity, right? It's going to run on a distributed electrical grid run on blockchain. So and so all of the digitally twinning of smart cities and of us as individuals, initially as healthcare records and then educational transcripts and whatever, are agents in the energetic landscape that's being applied towards some fitness measure that we may or may not have any control over, right? That is the evolutionary process. But in order to move things forward, when you shift the game board, when you change the nature of the game board into the next round, Schumpeter talked about something called creative destruction. At certain points, you have to destroy the old in order to build the new. And in the building the new, you have the economic growth model that we need. And so I've seen this so much in Philadelphia with redlining, because I live in a neighborhood that's just on the border of where the redlining happened in North Philadelphia. And so now that's all being redeveloped, right? So the economic structure has changed so that now the redevelopers can go in and get all of this land, much of which these were homes that were multiple generation black working class families who couldn't get loans to maintain their 100-year-old homes and so eventually had to give them up. And then the homes fall down, and then you have creative destruction, and then you build up the next smart town. And so I think that this idea of creative destruction is really important. And one of the people who was influenced by this idea of creative destruction was J. Wright Forrester, who was with MIT Sloan Business School, and he was working on simulation modeling systems. And so again, evolutionary economics, I believe, has to be understood now within the Web3 protocol layer, but we have to understand that there's social level evolution and then there's individual level evolution, and that in the individual level, we will be having medical digital twins, and there will be various wearables and then eventually implantables and then electroceuticals, bioelectric medicine, which is, you know, evolving now to guide our biology in that way. And so, you know, I've talked about in the past, again, the radiation hormesis, I feel like, is part of this as well. It's an energetic intervention into our bodies and into our relationships and into the way in which we transact and signal into the system that is going to be guided through the protocol layer. So this creative destruction idea is really important. And then I'm going to just touch on over here. A while back, I was doing some research on Pierre Omidyar and the Intercept, because I was taken in by Edward Snowden. And I would say it's very interesting that, I was not too savvy about how the media tease up the narratives, right? But Citizen 4, right? So there was the more popular movie about Snowden, and then Citizen 4 was a real-time documentary, right? And with Glenn Greenwald and I can't remember the other woman's name, the filmmaker. And they did it in real time in Hong Kong. And again, very interesting choice, right? Hong Kong, because Hong Kong and Shanzhai City, that's a center for, tokenizing the Hong Kong Time Bank. And that's something that Leo's talked about. He talked about in his recent guest post. So Snowden, again, when he was pulling information out of PRISM while he was working for the NSA as a Dell contractor, he was doing it in Hawaii. And I remember seeing the film and being sort of shocked that they went into this big underground bunker and that was all happening in Hawaii, because I didn't understand really the military history of signals intelligence, right, which is what the NSA is signals intelligence. I didn't understand that. So so Snowden with Greenwald and The Intercept, right? Again, like so many of our narratives were just being intercepted right and left. And so I had gone to an event at our free library, and it was a remote broadcast because Snowden was in, I guess he maybe still is in Russia. And he was there with Jeremy Scahill, was the in-person, and they were doing a talk. And I actually did an info picket there because I thought I was concerned about surveillance and educational technology in the schools. And I thought, oh, well, these would be my audience. But I got some very sketchy looks. Mostly the funders who were sitting in the funding area, the philanthropists, and there was somebody from Comcast who was really interested in how I knew about their internet technology, the Internet of Things technologies, and I said, well, it's on your website. So he kind of shadowed me for a while until I went into the event. But Pierre Omidyar owns The Intercept. He doesn't just give some grants. He actually literally outright owns The Intercept. And, of course, he and his wife, Pam, he is setting up Impact Finance, right? And my entry point was in educational technology, but it's so much more. His wife, Pam, is involved in health data analytics and platformed health data capture on health, especially tied to home visits, which is going to be an impact market. Again, he founded eBay. And again, I would say auctioning, if you think about auctioning, it's a signal. There's a pricing signal, right? In an auction, it is how many players are there bidding and at what price and a value. So I think if we understand eBay as a signaling mechanism, like that's really important to understand. So Pierre Omidyar also lives in Hawaii. So isn't that interesting? He's a resident of Hawaii. I'm sure he has properties in other places. It says he has properties in California and Mexico and is developing real estate in Cabo San Lucas. But yes, so Omidyar, signals, intelligence, technology, systems, the good ID. Pierre is all about the good identity because how are you going to transmit your signal if you don't have a coherence as an individual? You need your unique identifier so that you have coherence in all of the signals that you are emitting. And so I think it's very important to know that he is in Hawaii. Now, just in terms of other things, there was social impact bond legislation that was proposed in Hawaii in 2013. I'm not sure if it passed. But it was a bill for an act relating to social impact bonds. So they talked about, like, people, the Hawaiian legislators are very aware of social impact bonds. That was 2013. So, again, Ronald Cohen had his first big gathering. The G8 Task Force on Social Impact was in 2013. And then a few years later, there was parametric insurance legislation proposed. That was in 2017, Senate Bill 799, a bill for an act relating to natural disaster protection. And again, I just want to emphasize that, that's Leo's wheelhouse, and he has a recent guest post on my blog about parametric insurance. So they're pitching parametric insurance because it's a quick payout, right? And some of these early parametric insurance models had to do with coral reefs, which also were in Merida, Mexico, in the Yucatan Peninsula, because for tourism, the coral reefs, so you could see that there would be a similarity to Hawaii's economic interest. So here we have last November, in Artemis, which is sort of the catastrophe bond information source, that Munich Reinsurance backed parametric insurance launched for Hawaii's coral reefs. So again, put that together with the deep sea mining. And I wonder if there's any sort of insurance policies against negative impacts on coral reefs. Like what would those metrics be on, like a plume metric or a biosensor metric about the water quality? I could see that. Now, this is more about cyclone insurance, which I guess relates more to the tropical storm in California that we're dealing with. But again, I guess someone should check out and see if there's any parametric insurance for wind damage in Southern California and see how that's playing out. I will say that in Artemis 2, it also says that in terms of catastrophe bonds, that there is not an impact from Hawaii's wildfires. This was on the 11th of August. It said that even though there was all of this devastation, it's all about what the exposure is to the industry. And that it says that there isn't an impact on the catastrophe bond because our funds aren't really exposed, and most of the wildfire catastrophe bonds are centered on California. And even if they're just general catastrophe bonds, you know, that they don't see that there's a major financial impact, which is, again, that's how the world sees these things now, is it's all about the financing. So, and here's the image. If you're looking for Leo's newest piece around the role of the global insurance industry, specifically AXA Insurance, and how that's essentially interfacing with signals intelligence and homeland security and risk analytics and planetary simulations, because they're evidently, you know, there's work being done with the Matiga Solutions and Microsoft's planetary computer. You should go definitely check that out on my blog. It's about the second or third one in. So I think that's much of the lower level. So this is another thing. My familiarity, I've never been to Hawaii. My familiarity was initially when I was doing my education activism work. I knew a woman who was a teacher in Hawaii. She was not indigenous, but very active there around supporting public education. And so I had gotten to know her, and then she was also supportive of indigenous rights and was involved in the struggle against the 30-meter telescope on Mauna Kea. And there was a lot of protests there, and so she was an ally in protesting that, which is militarized infrastructure. I mean, I think most of us think of astronomy and we think about just like pretty pictures from outer space or, you know, these nice photos that come back, but really the telescope industry is a lot about the military side of things. So I was paying attention to Hawaii somewhat because of her, because Hawaii was also being targeted for competency-based education. And I would say this is something I want to talk a little bit more about with Leo and Jason, but competency-based education, Michael Levin, when he talks about embryology and morphogenesis and cell division and cell differentiation and how cells problem solve, he talks about competencies, the cell competencies. And so I guess actually I have this up at the top, but I believe that competency-based education, our digital twins with the competencies, is related to that. Is if we were a cell in a team, which is a tissue, which is doing some problem-solving behavior, that the competencies are how we're tracked in terms of putting together the right team for the right problem. And so the adoption of educational technology in Hawaii was really strong, but again, they were pushing back against the normal high stakes. I mean, there was still the normal high stakes testing, but it was transitioning towards project-based learning, where you're going to get these data points about social-emotional learning and team-building skills. And they were specifically also focused on indigenous cultural schools, mostly charter schools. And I'd seen this in other areas where they were developing specific charter schools to have culturally responsive curriculum for indigenous communities, which on the one hand is important, right? To me, it feels like the solution. If you've got the polarity of semi-symbio-human computation, where we're actually falling into the matrix, and then we have right relationships being respectful relative to the planet for the seven generations, like, yeah, I would lean more this way at this point, right? Why is it that charter schools are doing that? And I think actually it's because indigenous culture is, if you are looking for complex systems, a group, a culture that inherently was good at dealing with complexity, indigenous cultures would be that, because that is right relationship, is how are you in relation, not just to a buffalo or to, you know, a team seed plant or to yarrow or to, you know, or to the clouds or to the waters, to a river. It is all those things, and that is the system. And so indigenous knowledges look at things from a view that today they would call systems theory, systems thinking, right? But they don't call it that. But I can see if you were a systems theory manager, that would be very interesting to you to get that hooked into how you want to use it in the world, right? And so I feel like that push towards indigeneity and competencies is connected to that. So anyway, so I was looking at EdTech, you know, and again, I've been looking a lot at game design, video game mechanics. And at the time, I was looking at this organization called the Entertainment Software Association. This is a panel, oh gosh, I don't have the date on this, a number of years ago. It's the Future is Gaming panel, the transformative power of video games as a platform for education, health, and social impact. And for many years, I would look at that and I just took it at face value, right? I was looking at social impact and the data analytics for creating these derivatives products. And you know, creating a global surveillance state, right, for digital information. I wasn't actually looking at it for collective problem solving, which is, I think, what it is. And I think if you look at the crypto gaming industry, that is, the crypto gaming industry is important because if you're doing team problem solving in a space, if it's on a distributed ledger, you have a permanent record. And it's what you're doing is comparing it against a fitness landscape and doing prediction modeling. You want the game and the choice architecture to happen in a place that can be held as a permanent record that then you can do long-term AI computation on, modeling to make your prediction for the next crisis, problem, whatever you're doing. You'll want a record of all of the rounds of the game to make prediction modeling and see the patterns that would not be visible otherwise. And so that's why I think that the video game industry is moving into blockchain. It's not just so you can own your assets, right, and transfer your virtual items or, you know, build up the competencies in your avatars, which it is that, but I think it's larger for the system dynamics that they want a record for all of that. So the Entertainment Software Association is a major lobbying group for the industry. And here is, this is 6 years ago, so what would that be, 2017? The Reality Caucus launch. So Daryl Issa, who I believe is connected to Ohio, so Ohio is all of what we know about Ohio, right? Rockefellers and Battelle and all of that. So Daryl Issa, who had a background in technology, he launched a Reality Caucus to educate Congress about extended reality and issues for extended reality. Again, leaning into the gaming space. And this is just an article talking about May of 2017, congressional representatives create a reality caucus. One of the other co-sponsors of that was Suzanne Del Bene, and she came out of Microsoft, and she was a congresswoman from Washington State. So they are chairing they were chairing the reality caucus 6 years ago. Now, I have a dissertation, and it's interesting because it's actually out of Florida State, because Florida is a center for gaming, and military gaming, right? And this was, maybe it's just a paper. Jennifer Prophet, PhD, and Margot Suska, PhD, from Florida State College of Communication and Information. The title of their paper is Follow the Money, the Entertainment Software Association Attack on Video Game Regulation. And so, again, they're talking about it in a pretty straightforward way about the revolving door of influence between the gaming industries and politics. And here we have, there's a quote where they're talking about registered lobbyists for the Entertainment Software Association. And in 2007, it included Ken Inouye, son of Senator Daniel Inouye from Hawaii. And Ken Inouye, the son, has worked on behalf of News Corp and the Motion Picture Association of America. And then again, here they're saying that, you know, even legislators can be commodified by industry. So that connection between the Entertainment Software Association and Ken Inouye and Hawaii is important. And here his Ken's LinkedIn, it's pretty fragmented. He's listed as Senior Director of Government Affairs at Entertainment Software Association based in Washington. Evidently, his education, he got his undergraduate at George Washington University. So that's all that's on his LinkedIn. But so here's his dad and Daniel Inouye, and he has sponsored... He sponsored 2,100 bills and co-sponsored 6,200. So he was very prodigious in his policy making. I think he's since passed. But yeah, 8,400 different pieces of legislation. And what kinds of things was he involved with? He had a very long career in Congress. He went back to Johnson and Great Society. So we know Great Society, I think, was a set up for social programming, right? The social infrastructure, social computation that we're seeing laid out. He was ex officio in these different subcommittees, space, aeronautics, and related agencies. So that'll relate to the telescopes. Surface transportation and merchant marine infrastructure. And again, all of that was like, I don't know exactly when he left. So that's stuff that's being automated. Science, technology, and innovation. Ocean, atmospheres, fishery, and Coast Guard, aviation, safety, and security, and the Defense Subcommittee, right? So highly militarized. Space, innovation, oceans, security, and defense. Those were all things that he was working on. And so once we understand that the gaming industry, the video gaming industry, is about prediction modeling, and it is a militarized infrastructure, that's important because that's being melded not only into educational technology, but as educational technology becomes centered around, you know, group problem solving and lifelong learning, right? Like we'll never get off the ledger. We're all going to be involved in ongoing problem solving. That crypto model that's informing the prediction modeling is going to be moving forward in the game. I believe it's important that we understand it as a military game and that fifth generation warfare is a struggle for consciousness and the mind and narrative and story. So not to say that they're not going to still have bombs and nuclear missiles and threaten people because that they need people to feel physically threatened. But I believe the more important target is for consciousness. Right, and again, that's where we're seeing the balance between indigenous worldview of animist and shared consciousness, and an imperial worldview, which is, you know, empire and colonies, and ultimately the colony that they want to pull us into is a eusociality, a colony of social insects, where we're governed by circuitry, right? Even within our bodies, governed by circuitry that's no longer in our own control because we are electrical, right? We're already electrical, but with these other intervention by outside circuitry, and then our social transactions will be guided by circuitry. So here I just want to mention the Lahaina in Maui, that it was listed as a sacred site. Its significance, it says, in Native Hawaiian tradition, Moku'ula is the home of the lizard goddess Kiha Wahine and the former home and burial ground of Hawaiian royalty, right? So that's very symbolic. The destruction of that area is very symbolic. It says the site is part of a larger sacred geography relating to oral history. Moku'ula was home to the high chiefs of Maui from the 16th to the 18th centuries and the kings of the United Hawaiian Islands in the 19th century when Lahaina was the capital of the Hawaiian kingdom. So it's a very important, culturally significant area. And again, centering on this, again, it's problem, reaction, solution. There's a lot of conversation around housing, the housing crisis, and the ability of people to rebuild because it's one of the most expensive places in in the U.S., like the median home price is $1.7 million, and in this area it was even higher. And then a lot of indigenous people, their homes had been passed down from generation to generation, and they may or may not have been insured. So at that level. So there's a lot of questions about what happens next and this land grab. And that's all very appropriate, but I would just say the housing crisis is a focus of Impact Finance and Pay for Success. Affordable housing and workforce housing is a metric. And again, it's going to be framed as social well-being. And so that housing that's going to be able to be built to capture the data, real-time data flows for the financial deals will be smart housing. And then that will be, you know, you living in the outside in robot. So that housing, that's part of the housing thing. The other pieces, I've seen some narratives around, there were offers of some financial assistance, which were very modest given the scale of the impact. And the people, you know, who were displaced, especially when compared to the money that's been flowing into Ukraine, for example. And so that was being used to, again, reinforce the sort of persecution, ongoing persecution of indigenous Native peoples in that way. And yes, I believe that that is happening. But the thing I would say I want people to be aware of is that I believe that a tremendous resource that is seeking to be mined for this complex systems emergence is indigenous worldview, right? And so they want to actually uplift the narrative around indigenous sovereignty. And again, that's an interesting word. Like, who came up with the word of indigenous sovereignty? Because sovereignty is also connected to this whole agent program, right? And the Web3 structure. So the sovereignty issues, yeah, like it goes way back in terms of, you know, I know Stephen Newcomb has done his important work around U.S. property law is embedded in Native American law because it was all indigenous land before anyone else came here. So it's they're integrated. But I would just be mindful that the polarity is what drives it's always problem, reaction, solution. So it could very well be that indigenous communities are being set up several moves down the way for smart social impact housing, where they would then be under a digital surveillance regime, and the system would get what it most wants, which is having those communities within a digital panopticon to harvest and domesticate that perspective in extended reality. And so I would just say be mindful of how the problems are made to create, to drive the narrative forward into the solution that is desired, because indigeneity has always been the target. Attempted cultural erasure and hijacking, and I think it's not so much erasure anymore, but it is uplift and then harnessing it into the Web3 that is going to be coming. So again, talking about displacement and the Lahaina is the sacred place in the cultural capital. So symbolically, very, very important. And here is the Washington Post talking about the housing crisis, and that they might not be insured at the proper level, and that about the housing affordability. And very interesting is that we have an advertisement that's in the screenshot there. Normally I wipe those out, but this one's right in the middle, but it's for Catholic Relief Services, which is one of the leaders in disaster and social impact finance space. So, and of course, Washington Post is owned by Bezos. So you've got that. And so I'm just reinforcing that the militarization also applies to is throughout the kingdom, right? And, you know, hat tip to my friend Drew, who is in Tucson, and she's a descendant of the Hawaiian kingdom, and she was running for office in Arizona, and part of her platform was raising awareness that the Hawaiian kingdom was illegally overthrown and occupied. It's an illegal occupation, pretty much. So the militarization is incumbent on the fact that it is beyond the military strategic position in the Pacific, that it is an illegal occupation, ultimately. So the militarization of the land, that's been the subject of a lot of research study. And there has been contesting of that militarization and that occupation throughout the 20th century, right? And so this is, I just have a part of their website that's devoted to Hawaii and Hawaiian activism movements from 1960 to 2010. So there is that resistance. Here is another paper, The Militarizing of Hawaii, Occupation, Accommodation, and Resistance by Kyle Kajihiro. And here, it looks like the Mauna Kea. I hadn't really paid attention lately to where things were. And it's sad. It looks like the 30-meter telescope may be going ahead, but they may be removing some older telescopes. And again, they've appointed some indigenous people to the review committee. So the telescope people are saying that, counting that as a win. But the sacred nature of that land and the inappropriate presence of all the telescopes is something that was, there was a very strong prayerful pushback to that. And there was a lot of solidarity among indigenous people on the mainland as well, and allies, including the woman who was the teacher that I knew, in support of opposing the installation of these telescopes on Mauna Kea, which is a sacred mountain. So to me, this is the thing that we need to remember about what's coming with the smart city in Maui, is this history. And then, so then we have some signals intelligence, Station Hypo. So again, always a center for strategy and an outpost, you know, a distant outpost. In World War II, the Fleet Radio Unit Pacific, Station Hypo, HYPO, was one of those places where they collected signals, and then they did cryptographic intelligence. So again, we're looking at cryptography, and my I'll just put this down for a second. My book Cryptonomicon, I just finished it. It's kind of it's a thick one, but it's all about encrypted data, and it blends both World War II and contemporary, which was like 20 years ago, that's a Neal Stephenson book. But I believe that the encryption is actually about your encrypting your biology, because eventually the computation is going to happen within the biology, and that's why they're linking biophysics and social physics. So encryption and breaking code is really important if actually our biology becomes integrated into hybrid computation systems. So Station Hypo was one of two major allied signals intelligence units. It took its initial name from the phonetic code at the time for H, Haya Hawaii Radio Tower. And it was used to penetrate Japanese naval codes. And I guess there was some question about the whole Pearl Harbor and what actually happened with that in terms of timeliness of encryption or decryption. So lots of questions about Pearl Harbor. And then we've also got, this is CBS News from May 2019, an exclusive look inside NSA Hawaii, the front lines of intelligence gathering. So again, I think we need to understand that the intelligence isn't just geopolitics. It's all kinds of signaling that's happening, and Hawaii is a center for that. And it says that the NSA is the largest of the 17 U.S. intelligence agencies, and that the NSA Hawaii is very busy gathering intelligence and intercepting communications from China and North Korea. And then it does say in this article, anything that travels over the radio frequency waves or inside the electromagnetic spectrum, it can be collected. Okay. We have the ability to pull items that have been collected worldwide. Much of our reporting ends up on the desk of the president. So NSA Hawaii is super important. And again, signals intelligence, that's what the jumpstart system is. All of these things are emitting the radiation and the signaling for the simulation modeling, for the smart city platform, for the digital twin. So it's really important that we understand the signals intelligence in this larger context. And again, I already talked a little bit about Snowden, but like I was sucked into the drama. You know, I mean, we all get sucked into different kinds of drama. I'm trying to get a little bit more grounded about it. But again, Citizen Four and Snowden, I thought it was a really impressive movie. I didn't know what I didn't know. And that's what I keep emphasizing. If we can just set aside judgment, good, bad, controlled, op, who's what, whatever, whatever, let's just try to get some clarity, because as soon as we go to judgment, then we start blaming people. And the reality is that we're operating on the information based on what we know. So I wrote about Snowden and him being an employee of Dell when he was at the NSA, and I didn't realize that, you know, and Dell is super important in Austin, right, and in social impact, and not only in ed tech, but in biotech and healthcare systems, and that the largest, one of the largest clients of Dell is the NSA, right? I didn't know that. So that made me think really differently when the Dell Foundation was underwriting efforts to impose school report cards and undermine public schools in Philadelphia, because I thought at the time it was just about selling computers, but really it was about creating an infrastructure of the next generation to generate the signals they would need for the prediction modeling. And then, you know, Snowden, you know, we didn't have the whole story there about PRISM, right, and what he was doing in Hawaii. And I think the placement of Omidyar and Snowden both in Hawaii is interesting. So then when I was looking at Hawaii and the signaling, that brought me back to Henry Loomis. So on a couple of maps, I've had Alfred Loomis of Loomis Labs, and he made a whole bunch of money in early electrical grid systems in like the 1920s, and just so happened to have the right intelligence that he pulled all his money out right before the Depression, right before the crash. So he had all this money when nobody had any money. And then throughout the 30s, during the Depression, in Tuxedo Park, New York, which is, you know, a suburb outside the city, it's across the river, but not too far, a very exclusive enclave, he built his own private laboratory to do innovative research, including very sophisticated physics, and he would bring all sorts of leaders in that space, pay for their tickets and tour them all over the United States to come do physics in his lab in Tuxedo Park, New York. And so one of the scientists who did work there wrote a lightly fictionalized account of what it was like to work in this private research lab, and it was called Brainwaves and Death, and it had to do with EEG, brainwaves. And there was a biography written of this woman by, I think her name is Julia Conant, and that was her uncle. And so she wrote a whole book about Loomis Labs. And and then the guy who wrote Brainwaves and Death killed himself just before it actually was published. But then Loomis himself was the main bankroller of the MIT Radiation Lab, the RAD Lab. And what they say about World War II is that while the nuclear bombs ended the war, so to speak, it was really radar that won the war. It was radar and signaling that won the war. And again, in Cryptonomicon, I'll just pull this out again, the World War II, that really emphasizes the encryption and decryption, and the radar signaling. Other people use the radar, the intercept of the messages, and the decryption, and then the confusion. And so I think that's really important to understand when we imagine our bodies emitting signals. And we're an amazing computer unto ourselves, but what happens when we start interfacing with AI systems, right, and collective, you know, machine learning and fitness protocols and all of that? Like the precision medicine, I think they have much larger plans for this besides addressing cancer and regenerative medicine. But, yeah, so back to Loomis. So Albert Loomis did work with his son, Henry. Henry was also a physicist, so I'm going to just read this. This is from an article called Henry Loomis, the Physicist Who Led the Voice of America, again, what are you listening to, and Public Broadcasting. Henry Loomis was a physicist and the son of one of the most intriguing Americans of the early 20th century. But he is best remembered as the man who greatly expanded the reach of Voice of America before resigning to protest President Lyndon Johnson's demand that the network not report on American planes flying over Laos during the Vietnam War. Okay, so Henry's father, Alfred, Alfred was a fabulously wealthy Wall Street tycoon who survived the stock market crash in high style. Devoting himself to science, he built a magnificent private laboratory in his massive stone mansion in the exclusive enclave of Tuxedo Park. Father and son worked together researching radar and brain waves. Very important when you're looking at what Levin's talking about with morphogenesis and electricity. Visitors to the home included Albert Einstein, Enrico Fermi, and Niels Bohr. With World War II approaching, a young Henry dropped out of Harvard to enlist in the Navy. Assigned to the Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor, Loomis helped to establish radar training schools. So again, another important context bit for Hawaii is the signals intelligence and the radar. And so here is a map that I have of Alfred Loomis, the father. Then we have Henry over here, Voice of America. And again, the importance of narrative and story for global coordinating. That's important. He was on the board for 13 years of MITRE Corporation, and MITRE is involved in blockchain, nanotech, as well as impact finance. Another founder of MITRE Corporation was H. Rowan Gaither, who was a founder of RAND and an officer with the Ford Foundation, and sort of a fixer with Alfred Loomis. They were close. So they were both connected through MITRE. And again, Alfred Loomis helped fund the radiation lab, which was working in microwaves and radar. And this was funded and overseen by Vannevar Bush. And Vannevar Bush, interestingly enough, actually graduated from his undergrad, did his undergrad and his master's program at Tufts, which is where Michael Levin is now teaching, and he was working in radio frequency design then. So Vannevar Bush, and then eventually he founded the NSF after the war. They were conducting the Manhattan Project work under the National Defense Research Committee, and the Rad Lab was there. So you can see on the back end, Henry being at this outpost in Hawaii is important. Here we have... again, the radiation lab, Alfred and Henry. Alfred was coordinating on the EEG and the centrifuge microscope with a guy by the name of E. Newton Harvey, who is a zoologist and interested in bioluminescence and luciferase in addition to EEGs. And think about bioluminescence and the deep sea mining, because I'm not totally convinced that all they're interested in down there are those nodules. I think they're actually probably also interested in those ancient life forms, because a lot of the research into embryology has happened out of Woods Hole and Scripps. Like, it's those tiny little creatures that they're interested in, not just big whales and dolphins. It's the little things and how how cells communicate. That's sort of and how the neurons, the information communication theory, is what a lot of the marine life sciences stuff is. And I had no idea about that. But in the deep sea is where you get those bioluminescence things, right? So they might be interested in what's going on with that. They might be mining life forms down there too. Harvey's wife Ethel, she was at Bryn Mawr, and she was an embryologist working on sea urchins at Wood's Hole on cell cleavage, which is exactly what Levin is sort of interested in, that morphogenesis and embryology. So I think that's a very interesting trajectory. And again, we just have Tuxedo Park and Vannevar Bush. Bush was also the president of the Carnegie Institute. And the Carnegie Institute was allied with the Carnegie Corporation. They were doing scientific research. But again, Carnegie is also interested in world peace, and that will be achieved through the homeostasis of the electrical energy grid smart contract layer. Henry Loomis, besides working at Voice of America, for 4 years he was an assistant to James Killeen, who was at the time president of MIT, and he founded the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Carnegie Corporation. So again, all of this broadcasting is happening. And again, managed consciousness. Like, we're into fifth generation warfare, but it's been going on for some time. Another president of Carnegie Corporation was John Gardner. He was with the OSS, again, the precursor to the CIA, and he was a UN delegate in health, education, and welfare and involved in education testing service. So I would say it's interesting to think about, like, this education testing service is, what if the entire time it's been going back to agent-based modeling, right? You're testing people to find out their psychometrics. You're testing people to find out their internal qualities. Like, really, that's what all, like, human resource work is about. Like, you're testing them to find out the parameters of what they are as a unit that can be plugged in with other units for some problem-solving purpose of social computation. So I think that's quite interesting. And how would you get a handle on people? Well, it is through their basic needs, which is their health needs, their food, their education. So all of those systems of the great society would be packaging people to get the information to steer them into the right position, like, you know, the Tetris of society. And then this last one. Okay, I have. We're over here. So WGBH Boston was one of these early public broadcasting stations. And again, I remember it from back in the day, like after school, you'd listen to Zoom. There was Zoom, 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 brought to you by WGBH Boston, whatever. And like, I remember Zoom and, you know, child of the 70s, these things get imprinted in your head. But I didn't really know the backstory. So this was connected to the Lowell Cooperative Institute. And again, we've got cooperatives because cooperatives are, again, cells, like uniting. And the first WBBGH Boston radio broadcast was the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And WGBH had studio space in Boston Symphony Hall. So there you've got acoustics, right? And you have computational acoustics and frequency modulation, right? Imagine steering society through noise and acoustics and music, right? And so you've got the music broadcast, and it's transmitted through the Great Blue Hill Transmitter in Milton, Massachusetts. And it was the site of an early weather radar. It's in a meteorological observatory area. So they had a meteorological observatory and the big transmitter. And so this guy, Abbott Lawrence Rotch, was a pioneer meteorologist. So then I'm sort of thinking back to Patrick Ryan and the human weather systems and the frequency. And interesting to take a look at what the compositions were featured at that first broadcast. Mozart, again, we've got Vienna, Mozart's Masonic funeral music, 1785. And then you've got Death and Transfiguration, a tone poem by Strauss, 1889. And you have Symphony 6, Pathétique by Tchaikovsky, his final symphony. So you've got a lot of death, transformation, transfiguration going on in that. And then you have Aaron Copland gave the opening remark. So it's very American, Americana. And then the death and transfiguration. So so the person who gave the money for the transmitter, his name was Edwin Howard Armstrong. He got a degree from Columbia. He was a brilliant electrical engineer. He invented FM radio and an idea of super heterodyning, which is like when you mix two signal waveforms and you bring them together to create a third one. And so he butted heads with the guy Sarnoff at RCA and lost a bunch of money and then eventually committed suicide. It was very tragic. But he was in the Signal Corps in World War I, so he understood the frequency. So I just thinking about frequency, heterodyning, masking, signals intelligence, the Loomis Labs, brainwaves and death, and that like they're working on now brainwave modulation through biofeedback. Right, and there are these patents that are out there about sampling remotely brainwaves and then pairing them up and then implanting a new brainwave in there so that you're thinking something else. They've been working on the biofeedback since the 70s, if not earlier, at least publicly. So there was a paper called Hedonics and Modulation of Adaptive and Maladaptive Features of the Human Affectome, right? So, and that was 2019, so that's a recent paper. So they're interested, the human affectome is sort of your energetic, emotional state. your affect. And so imagine you're living in a panopticon. It's monitoring you for sentiment analysis, emotion awareness. There's the huge push now for, you know, therapy, emotional management monitoring. You know, your AI is going to learn you and be your good assistant to help, you know, get you over the bumps. And then what that is, if you have these signals and then you have the potential that you could live in the outside in robot and then have the robot adjust your affectome, you know, over time. So again, all of this history is kind of in the background of Hawaii Signals Intelligence with the NSA. For me, anyway, that's how I think about things. And I'm going to talk, I have a couple of clips here from Mike Levin. I pretty much pulled the whole talk into little clips, and Jason and Leo and I are going to do a more extensive discussion of this. But I would like to share you, and I'd like to just thank my friend Darushan, who alerted me to this talk. Darshan wrote up a couple posts on slime mold because, again, the slime mold is this decentralized intelligence, computational and sensing distributed cognition, and they're very interested in that. And so I really appreciated getting this talk by Levin. And so he is literally talking about reading and writing information into biology using electricity. So I have two clips that I'm going to play, but I do want to point out here about Vannevar Bush. That he got his BA and MA from Tufts in 1913, and that he worked on the campus American Radio and Research Corporation that was eventually merged with Magnavox. And then while he was at MIT, he and his former Tufts roommate created the American Appliance Company, which later became Raytheon, right? And so Raytheon does all sorts of defense contracting, including, you know, directed energy and all kinds of frequency, managing frequencies for various purposes. So I do want to point out that there does seem to be, at least through the school basis, a connection with Levin teaching at Tufts and Vannevar Bush getting 2 degrees from Tufts. So I'm going to just play this.
It turns out that this is an ancient, this kind of system is evolutionarily ancient. It goes back to bacterial biofilms. Every cell in your body has ion channels. It turns out that this is an ancient, this kind of system is evolution.
Sorry, that one didn't work out so well. Okay, so, all right. Okay, let me try that again. I was trying to, like, expand it, but I don't know, maybe YouTube has changed. Oh, there it is. Okay.
It turns out that this is an ancient, this kind of system is evolutionarily ancient. It goes back to bacterial biofilms. Every cell in your body has ion channels. Most cells have these electrical connections. And we can do the same kind of decoding, this kind of non-neural decoding, by looking at electrical activity. This happens to be an early frog embryo. We're visualizing the electrical patterns. And again, try to decode, where is it trying to get to in anatomical morphospace? And so we developed the first molecular tools to read and write these things. So here's our use of voltage-sensitive dyes to control the bioelectric patterns within embryos to read out what all the electric communications are. Of course, we do a lot of computational modeling and simulation to understand how they connect to the channels and pumps that produce them. Beyond reading these, basically reading the mind of this morphological collective intelligence of cells, we have the ability now to write information into that as well, as people like Tanigawa do in the brain when they incept false memories into mice. So what we can do is we can take all of the tools from neuroscience. And so this is very important. The tools of neuroscience really don't distinguish between neural and non-neural cells. They all work. The concepts, the laboratory techniques, the neurotransmitter machinery, like everything works. So what we can do is we can control the gap junctions, which cells talk to each other cells, and we can control the actual electrical states by opening and closing these ion channels. So remember, there are no magnets here. There are no fields, no waves, no radiations, no electrodes. We are using the native interface that cells use to program each other. There's this electrical interface on their surface that controls the information processing, and this is how cells hack each other's behavior during normal development. And also, by the way, how some parasites hack their hosts.
All right. So, Yeah, so reading and writing and imprinting false memories into cells. So, okay, so I'm going to just do this one too.
If you cut them in half, the bottom end grows a tail, the top end grows a head. But these cells that you just separated were next door neighbors before you cut them. How come they have completely different anatomical fates? That question cannot be answered locally. You can't tell from where you are what you should build. You have to communicate with the rest of the body and figure out what's missing. So this is non-local decision making. So we ask this question: when you amputate this planarian, how do you know how many heads you're supposed to have? And it turns out that there's an electrical gradient that we characterize that tells you how many heads you're supposed to have. And if you and what you can do is you cut off the head and the tail, and this middle fragment will regrow a nice perfect worm 100% of the time. But because we understood this gradient, we were actually able to make these two-headed worms by taking this electrical. So here it says one head, but now we can say no, actually you should have two heads. And sure enough, this isn't Photoshop, these are real animals. They make nice two-headed forms. Now here's the really important part. This bioelectric map is not a map of this two-headed creature. This bioelectric map is a map of this one-headed creature. So what we did was we rewrote the bioelectricals, the stable bioelectrical pattern memory in this one-headed animal, and it stays one-headed with a normal gene expression. So here, anterior genes only in the head, not in the tail. And it sits there perfectly happy like this until it's injured. So a single planarian body is able to store at least two different representations, two different ideas of what a correct planarian looks like, and sit there, and it's a latent memory. It doesn't do anything until you injure the animal. The same body, the same one-headed body, can store two different representations. So at the very beginning, I told you that this collective intelligence works towards, it's a homeostatic loop that works towards a specific set point. And the question was, how do you store a set point for anatomy? This is it. You are literally looking at an example of how pattern memories are stored. They're stored as a stable bioelectrical state in tissue. And it's this in particular is kind of cool. It's a counterfactual memory because this is not a representation of what's happening now. It's a representation of what you're going to do in the future if you get injured. This is memory. It's long-term stable. It's rewritable. It has conditional recall, as I just showed you, or latency, and it has discrete behaviors. So what we're doing is we're reading and writing patterns into the collective intelligence of these cells that must navigate anatomical space. And so now what that means is that we can really do the kind of computational work of fleshing out the connections between the electrical state space of the circuit that we understand with so all kinds of ideas from connectionist computational neuroscience to understand how electrical networks can store patterns, do pattern completion, and navigate spaces intelligently. Full stack model.
Okay. So I just want to point out that in... when he was talking about the planaria, that it could hold two patterns, right, at once of what is correct, and the second one would be activated upon injury, right, and that was implanted, and then the plan was stored electrically throughout the tissues, so it could always regrow the two heads if that injury happened. So I would suggest that we consider how that applies to social infrastructure, socio-technical systems, because I feel like it's related, and I feel like when you have disasters in communities, it's possible that in the social system, through signals, whatever those are, whether those are ended up being embedded in our biology or an economic transaction or in smart buildings, that upon some sort of trauma, there could be activated the outside-in robot, and the outside-in robot could even be outside in your body too, could be activated to steer another pattern, to regenerate another pattern. And within the sustainability framing, you'll hear a lot of language around resilience, right? Resilience and the ability to come back after disaster, because the idea of perpetual disaster, however those are represented, that's that's part of the narrative too. So to me, I see the biophysics there being applied to social physics very directly. And you know, when the people, these nice little people who are down here and they're, you know, they're being asked to, you know, participate in this nice little project because they feel like it's something that's going to help the world, right? Like a smart car. You know, these are all sweet little people who believe that they're there, and by, like, you know, buying a smart car and being on the decentralized grid, that they're going to save the world, right? Or they're going to be part of the solution to save the world. People don't even have any idea that there are other aspects that may be in play around biophysics. They would have no idea about that. But I think it's important that we start to think about it. So up here, I just want to mention there's a really interesting paper. And this guy, the author, it might sound out there, and it actually was accessed it via BYU, but it might not have been a BYU person who wrote it. John Grazel. I think he actually had ties to USAID. And so it's called Polynesian Civilization and the Future Colonization of Space. And for me, in doing this research, especially around the presentation I did in Tucson last fall, and Tucson is the intersection, again, of telescopes, like Hawaii, consciousness, which is like Stuart Hameroff, and getting a lot of funding from the Fetzer Institute, and space colonization, which is the L5 Society, the Meunier family. So space and colonization are... space and consciousness are sort of intertwined. And I'm increasingly feeling like maybe outer space isn't so outer and it maybe is more inner, because that would be consistent with the big push for psychedelics. But the idea of a space colonization is suited to distributed systems, right? Because as Trent McConaughey, he always says, you know, monkeys in tin cans was never going to go well, so we might as well upload our brain to the cloud and go that way. That's part of it. I don't know that we're actually going to space in any, you know, I don't even know that that's the thing. But even, like, they're interested, I think there's an intertwining of space, the idea of space colonization and consciousness. So when I was looking at Polynesian culture and the future of space colonization, and this is from the abstract, they're talking about it being a model because it's a distributed culture that is intact over thousands and thousands of miles, and then over long periods of time, and that they were able to develop these ocean-going vessels and navigate over this open water, which would be like space. And so a lot of that was undermined, again, when the West, you know, discovered these islands. And, you know, the colonizing mindset, those ways of knowing were subsumed, but not disappeared. And then there was a resurgence in the 1970s, again, along with a lot of indigenous resurgence in other parts, you know, the Alcatraz Island and launching and then continuing on to Standing Rock and Mauna Kea and many other, and, you know, clearly indigenous resistance and resurgence is central in Latin and Central America. So they started re-knowing about these ways of navigating and holding their civilization intact across these differences. So it says, however, in the 1970s, there began a pan-Polynesian revitalization, including and exhilarated by the resurrection of traditional blue ocean navigation. This paper explores the role of navigation as a major institutional repository of Polynesian civilization writ large, as well as the analytic importance of differentiating between culture and civilization, and the possibility that Polynesian civilization is beginning a gregarious flowering in preparation for its participation in the coming dispersal of humanity into interstellar space. And I would say gregarious flowering is kind of interesting because a lot of the languaging we're hearing now is around human flourishing, and flourish comes from old French, I think, fleur, which is flower. And one of the articles that I looked at, I didn't pull out this, but they were talking about navigation and magnetic pull, and actually like testicular navigation, like you would sit men would sit with on the bottom of the boat, and they could feel like a tug towards the magnetic poles. But there were also many, to me, in looking at how they describe blue ocean navigation, they talk about it that there was oral tradition, song, okay, so again, we've got frequency and communication, information communication through song and frequency, and that this Polynesian tribe, they used outrigger double-hulled canoes, and there's thousands and thousands of miles distance that they would travel, and the navigation techniques included so use of the stars. This was non-instrumented, as far as I understand, at least historically, without instruments. So the location of the stars, the movement of the ocean currents, and being able to read the ocean and the waveforms off of islands, even from very far distances. Patterns of bioluminescence, air and sea interference patterns, the flight of birds, and the winds and the weather. And so they would use all of this information together to do their navigation processes. And to me, that feels a lot like systems thinking. Again, what today is called system thinking. Looking at a way a system's parts interrelate and work over time in a broader context, as opposed to breaking pieces down individually and looking at them separately. It's synthetic. I don't want to bring those amazing talents down by calling them systems theory. But I can imagine, again, if you're a systems theorist, you would be very interested in people who had that capacity. Intergenerational capacity to think situationally in context and through systems. And so this is a playlist that I made. I was revisiting, this is Jim Heckman's gathering of his social-emotional learning people at the University of Chicago, and this one I hadn't paid close attention to. There's another woman from Educational Testing Service, and she was talking about cultural competencies. And again, I keep thinking about Levin's use of competencies and cellular competencies, and I swear I think that she did a program that was with the military and using gaming to practice cultural competencies for army officers or something like that, and doing that in a video game. I couldn't find that one, but I found this one instead. And he's talking about psychometrics and using SimCity and sustainability with middle school students to learn about systems thinking. And it's clear that there's a great, great interest in instilling the idea of systems thinking in young people and in teaming. So I feel like if you were interested in that as a psychometric profile, as a competency, that the Polynesian culture of Hawaii would be of interest. And again, Hawaii is a center for competency-based education. You can see up here, this is the Board of Education Hawaii meeting minutes from 2015. They're all pitching competency-based education coming, and that's project-based learning. Here in this report, they're directing people to other states, including Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire, and Colorado, which are all leaders. And clearly, Colorado is leader in blockchain, and Maine was the leader after Chugach, Alaska, in the competency-based education development. Talking about personalized learning, anytime, anywhere, again, that works with video game design and student voice. So the authenticity is about, again, building out your digital twin, building the competencies so they'll know where to plug you into the game. I had mentioned before the charter schools that were focused on indigenous culture, and there's several, but one of them includes Malama Honua in Waimanalo, Hawaii, a public charter school for K-8. 165 students, a Hawaiian culture community-focused project-based learning community. Again, so that's how you find out about the children. And then, let's see. This is just, so Ted Dintersmith is busy bringing this to Hawaii, and he's a venture capitalist, and he's bringing it to North Dakota and Hawaii. And so he jumped on one of my blog posts from years ago, 2018, and he talks about, he's a super good guy, he's very well-meaning, he's not doing anything untoward. He spends his time doing his best to help all the schools in North Dakota and Hawaii, and he spends his time on the UN Foundation Model UN Initiative, and Learn Fresh, helping students master math through an in-school board game based on basketball. So Dintra Smith is in Hawaii. Here's just another blog post talking about that he showed up in Hawaii in 2016, and he's visited the island 13 times, although I guess if I were a venture capitalist, I would look for an excuse to come to Hawaii. It's so beautiful. And he's working on sustainability, project-based learning relating to sustainable development goals, but he's paired with the Hawaii Venture Capital Association. So again, doing it for impact finance purposes. Oops. Sorry about that. And so here is Ted's LinkedIn. Here he is, a delegate to the United States Department of State, U.S. United Nations mission. He did that in 2012. Focused on global education issues, collaborating with UNICEF, and again, UNICEF is connected to blockchain, and the UN Foundation and the Secretary's Office of the UN. So Ted is down there. There he is, successful venture capitalist, spending millions of dollars to help students learn. But again, in Forbes, the headline on this is how a former VC wants to disrupt American education. And so, yes, it is a disruption for project-based learning. And KnowledgeWorks, which is really the leader, KnowledgeWorks and Strive Together Cradle to Career Pipeline, both based out of Ohio, Cincinnati, Ohio, their leads, and I still am on their email list, and so they submitted a new report. Really, if you want to know where things are headed, at least with education and its interface with technology, just sign up for their emails and look through their white papers because they just tell you. But they're pitching iLearn, which is essentially built off U.S. Naval Research Lab program called PAL, which is an AI-assisted learning device for personalized learning, only in this case, they're pitching a future where the PAL is actually the child, the AI is the thing, and the PAL is the child, and the PAL teaches the AI, and essentially I'll read just a little bit of this. Now remember, this is about wearable technology and signaling and coordination. So getting children used to being steered by an outside agent that's listening, that they'll have like in their ear or in a plush stuffed animal companion or something to tell them what to do next and guide their thinking so that they arrive at the right answer. And we have to understand this in terms of agents in collective computation, I believe. PALs can select their iLearn physical form to accommodate different developmental strategies, needs, and lifestyles. For example, iLearn can start as a plush toy for a toddler and then be inserted into a compatible bracelet during preschool years. A bracelet, right? It's like a handcuffs, your tracker device, or it can take the form of a watch, earrings, or glasses for teenagers and young adults. This shape-shifting ability allows iLearn to stay by its PAL's side and nurture lifelong learning skills. As iLearn spends more and more time paired with its PAL, it understands better and adapts to its PAL's unique cultural, again, culture is really important, and I think a lot of the critical race theory and the emphasis on culture is about highlighting culture to get it into the machine for machine computation purposes, to adapt to its PAL's unique cultural and accessibility needs, thought processes, life changes, and emotional, mental, and physical well-being preferences. When its PAL asks a question, iLearn won't just provide an answer. Instead, it will support and nudge its PAL until they find a satisfactory, evidence-based answer together. Right, and so the PAL is essentially like your extended self that is just monitoring you and bossing you around throughout the rest of your life, and they're conditioning the children to that. But why would they be doing that? It's not just because they're excited about controlling children. It's that they're interested in using the creativity of children and harnessing it into collective problem solving, into complexity and emergence. So if, you know, you're going to do competency-based education, you're going to do it with Internet of Everything and wearables and your PAL steering, right? And as it's steering you, it's learning you, and then it's feeding all of that learning into the AI systems, in my opinion. And so early on, there, my colleague, Emily, she was a teacher in Maine. She was a second-grade teacher, and they brought all of this stuff into her school and her school district, and she just, it wasn't adding up. And she is a smart woman, and she started looking into it and pulling at the threads like me and looking at the money and mapping it all out. And her blog, it was called Saving Maine Schools. I think it's no longer active, unfortunately. But she documented that what was coming in terms of competency-based education to Maine, it came from Alaska. And it was at very high-level individuals, including Tom Vander Ark was involved, and he was an officer for the Gates Foundation in education and the first principal of the first, like, state-level virtual school. And they were targeting indigenous communities in Chugach, Alaska, specifically. And they were getting feedback on cultural competencies. And so they would ask these indigenous elders, well, what do you value for students? Now, remember, Battelle is pitching in P21st Century Skills, Portrait of a Graduate, right? That's going to be your mastery transcript. What is the portrait? So they were asking these indigenous elders, well, what qualities do you value for your children? What do you want for them? And they, and one of them said, well, we want our children to have a good humor about them, like a good way in the world, a good humor. And so that was incorporated into the competency-based education as a rubric for, like, a show's appropriate demonstrations of good humor. And then there were metrics about how that would look so that that could be fit into the game. Now, it's really only been within the past 6 months that I've realized, okay, competencies, cellular competencies, if we as agents are the equivalent of cellular intelligence, and then we have, like, we're multicellular intelligence, right, that the way in which they want to track competencies in cells and navigate them and manipulate them using bioelectronics and bioelectroceuticals is the same way that they would like to steer us through electronics and electroceuticals. So, but this, again, not just indigenous Hawaiian cultures being targeted, but all sorts of native cultures around, because I think that's the polarity. It's an animist, sacred, centered, being in right relationship to an enlightenment mechanized prediction modeling process. And it's this struggle back and forth for, like, which side, where are we going to align? Where are we going to align in this and understanding it that, but for the most part, people aren't seeing that struggle. So at the time, Chugach won this special award from NIST, which again is smart city technologies and atomic clocks and all of that. So think back to Maui and the smart village pilot. And, you know, it really fell apart in Maine. It was a disaster. No one understood why we were doing competency-based education, why we were no longer doing grades, why it was this whole other thing. And, of course, no one can say to the teachers of Maine and the parents in Maine, well, you see, since World War II, we've been, like, tapping into signals intelligence and cybernetics, and we have this goal of building a networked global superintelligence. And so in the future, your children are simply going to be treated as units, interchangeable units in complex teaming systems for problem solving. So we need to create a blockchain system that has all of your just-in-time qualifications so that we could drop you in to put you in for a team to solve the problem to save the world, right? Like, they can't even, there's no way of saying stuff like that. It sounds ridiculous to say something like that. So, but nobody can get why this is happening. So people struggle, like, they'll say, like, oh, it's the communists, or oh, it's China, or oh, it's about ed tech, it's Ted Dintersmith wanting to make money off the children, or oh, it's, you know, trying to boss us all around when we just want to have local governance and you're going to try to put us into this global system. And on the front end, you know, it's some of that, it could be some of that, but we're not getting to the deeper structural level of why. And for me, why is based on the socio-technical side of things. So I'm sort of thinking at this point, and just going back to Melanie Swan's 2016 paper, The Future of Brain-Computer Interfaces, Blockchaining Your Way into a Cloud Mind, where this is 2016, you know, and she came out of Purdue and then she went to University College London. And they're talking about BCIs and selling your unused brain cycles to the cloud and having tiers of advancing complexity of implementing this, starting with health tracking, right? Because all this is really, I mean, I think the ed tech is part of it, but the ed tech is maybe not as close with the wearables as the health tech. So starting with the health tech and then moving on. And then eventually, this cloud mind, you would engage with multiple individual minds or even machine minds into systems of problem solving. And then she's talking about how great it will be to have blockchain that will be tracking your credit assignments of your collaborations, that's how that's all going to work, the credit assignments. So just, you know, it might sound far off that we're talking about collective mind, and yet in 2016, people at high levels who are, you know, Purdue is home to the sentient world simulation, are talking about this, right? Not just because they want to steer you around like a puppet because they would like to use you to solve some big gnarly problem, right? So here they're saying, you know, people want to get credit for their the work that they do in the group mind, and that blockchains would keep an ultimate transcript of everything so everyone gets the proper attribution as soon as you log in. And so I'm playing around with this mentally, and I'm sort of thinking, I emailed this to a couple people, but I said it's my gut sense that they need agents to have all of their intellectual contributions attributed as competencies, because Levin talks about cellular competencies. So a multi-agent system for problem solving would need to be able to pull together just-in-time modular teams, depending on the nature of the problem. Repositories of digital twins would have all these different teams, right? So if you have a digital twin, you can have AI sorting through the optimum team, the A team, right? The A team to address the problems, right, in your game B scenario, what have you. And that AI would make a prediction on what the best team would be and put them in place. And that the idea that global platform gig labor combined with UBI, right? So you get this baseline, not you don't get to live in a flourishing way, but you get to subsist with a UBI, and then your position on the teams based on your competencies, that would be dropping in this additional gig labor for problem solving. And so that's what I think the mastery transcripts are in the skill badges. It's for problem solving. But through this problem reaction solution, we're going to get to micropayments and digital identity. And so I would just ask people, when you're listening to the common narratives around around AI, right, and around copyright and intellectual property, not that I'm saying that it's not, that it's okay for them to scrape all that data and use it without any compensation, but ultimately they want us to all accept a digital identity and to get paid in micropayments. That's where it's driving. And if that's what it is, then we, in our micropayment revenue stream, we have our digital identity and we have our competencies attached to us, and they're in aggregate for this universal teaming. And I think that's where the system is actually going. So I would just caution people when they're focused on the AI system to understand that it's more complicated than it is a problem reaction solution, and the solution they want is that we get a digital identity. So I'm just going to pause here for a minute and get a little bit of dinner.